You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, John Kerry is in Iraq to offer support in return for political change. Raffaello Pantucci, Senior Research Fellow at RUSI, and Isabel Hilton, Editor of China Dialogue, will join me to discuss that and all the big stories of the day. Then we'll lighten the tone a touch and speak to the author, Ivan Vladislavich, about his book The Restless Supermarket, newly released here in the UK, to find out what it says about South Africa today. And we'll hear one of the unconventional national anthems we're featuring throughout the World Cup tournament in Brazil. Today is the turn of Mexico.
For any Mexicans, when you listen to La Bamba, immediately you do this. Porque es arriba y arriba y arriba. Yo no sé, es fantastic. It's a lovely song.
All that, plus we'll round up the news in Athens and review the week's art exhibitions with Ossian Ward from the Listen Gallery. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to look forward to then in the next hour here on the programme. Before we begin, let's get the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News with James Luckhurst. The US Secretary of State John Kerry has promised intense and sustained US support for Iraq, but says the country will only survive if its leaders take urgent steps to bring it together. Hours before Mr. Kerry arrived in Baghdad, Sunni tribes who've joined a militant takeover of northern Iraq seized the only legal crossing point with Jordan, according to security sources, leaving troops with no presence along the entire western frontier, which includes some of the Middle East's most important trade routes. Officials have called for Iraqis to form an inclusive government. The Qatari news network Al Jazeera has urged Egypt to overturn a court ruling against three of its journalists, condemning the 7-year prison sentences as unjustified and defying logic. The three, who include Australian Peter Grester and Canadian-Egyptian national Mohamed Fahmy, denied the charges. The third defendant, Egyptian producer Bahi Mohamed, received an additional 3-year sentence on a separate charge involving possession of ammunition. Grester's brother Mike had this reaction to the verdict.
Wrong verdict. I don't know how the judge came to that decision. I'd be very interested to hear his reasons for giving that verdict. It doesn't make any sense.
And the British ambassador to Egypt, James Watt, condemned the verdict.
I'm sure my government will want to make its own statement about the outcome of this trial today. But for now, I can say that, of course, we're deeply disappointed at the outcome. From the start, we've had deep concerns about the process being applied to the trial, and we've conveyed those concerns to the Egyptian authorities on several occasions.
Condemnation has also come from the White House and the Australian government. Security sources in Nigeria say an explosion has torn through a state college in the northern city of Kano, killing at least 7 people. The explosion hit the Kano State School of Hygiene, though it's not immediately clear if Islamist militants were behind the attack. Correspondents say bombings and attacks by armed insurgents now happen almost daily in Nigeria's north, where the militant group Boko Haram is trying to carve out an Islamist state. The Israeli army has detained another 37 Palestinians as it searches for 3 missing teenagers. 361 people have now been held since the Israeli students went missing on June the 12th. Officials from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons say Syria has today handed over the remaining 100 tons of toxic material it had declared. However, the watchdog's chief says the country cannot yet be declared free of the weapons of mass destruction. The chemicals represent roughly 8% of a total of 1,300 tons reported to the OPCW, which had been held at a storage site, which the government of President Bashar al-Assad previously said was inaccessible due to fighting with rebels. OPCW Chief Ahmed Uzumchu explained the development at a press conference today.
A major landmark in this mission has been reached today. The last of the remaining chemicals identified for removal from Syria were loaded this afternoon aboard Danish ship Ark Futura. The mission will continue its work and they will continue to collect information from every available source.
And finally, Russia has been warned that the European Union is ready to impose further sanctions against Moscow if it's not satisfied with the response to a peace plan for East Ukraine. The United States has already threatened sanctions on Russia's financial, defense and high-tech industries as more Russian military material has flown into Ukraine. And that's the latest news here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, James Luckhurst. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we're back right after this.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06, 13.06 in New York City. Well, joining me now with their take on the news of the day here in Studio One are both Raffaello Pantucci, Senior Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, and Isabel Hilton, Editor of China Dialogue. Welcome both to the programme. Great to have you with us. Here at Midori House, we'll start in China, where a recent attack in the city of Hotan in Jianjing by a group of men armed with axes and knives has revealed again the tension in the far west province. A state broadcaster has shown the last surviving assailant apologising for the attack, claiming he was convinced by the promise of jihad. We've seen another attack where police killed a number of would-be assailants in recent days. Isabel, if I can start by asking you about this. Some sort of commentators are suggesting that the terrorists, these militants, are emboldened, that they've become arrogant. They're approaching their work, if you like, with a certain degree of swagger. Are you detecting that sort of thing, or do you detect a group of people who are very desperate and are trying anything they can?
I think I would favour the desperation side. I'm not quite sure where the swagger comes in. They're using quite primitive methods, and these missions are pretty much certain death. They attack with knives. These are not sophisticated. And I think that also speaks to the fact that this is a relatively isolated group, actually. I mean, these are, if you look at the people who staged the most dramatic episode in terms of mainland China, which was the explosion in Tiananmen, the car explosion in, well, actually, they ran in a car into a
Tiananmen. Flaming thing.
Indeed. That was a married couple and a mother-in-law. Now, these are not swaggering terrorists. These are people whose local mosque had been destroyed. There's a degree of frustration and rage which has been building since 2009, when there was the last major mass incident. And there has been, several years now of narrowing of the conversation, of arrests, of executions, and people do feel that there's no way out.
So, Raffaello, if we follow that logic, then we're looking at this escalation of violence. People are increasingly desperate. Then are they radicalised? Is that an unhelpful word to use then, or are they just seeking to advance their cause in any way that they can?
Well, I think it's a mix, and I think that the one element I would say is I do think that we are seeing a problem that's escalating here. And I think that's in terms of, we used to see incidents in Xinjiang tended to happen in places like Khotan. It was sort of in the south of the province. And I think the lesson of the past year really has been that these people, individuals who are, in some cases, I would argue they are probably more radicalized and are certainly going in the direction of what looks like a terrorist incident. A couple of attacks we had in Urumqi earlier this year, one was a bombing at a train station. The other was someone driving a truck and throwing some bombs at crowds in a Urumqi market. Those are sort of terrorist incidents that took some sort of planning organization and are shaped more like terrorist incidents that we recognize. What we see here is difficult to sort of categorize in some ways, because tensions in that part of the province in the south of Xinjiang are such that, some small incident might spark off some sort of fight, which escalates to a number of deaths and a clash with security forces, that then subsequently the reporting we get out from is the state media perspective, which tends to be very much the government's narrative of terrorist gangsters, thugs, whichever word they choose, attack local authorities. And then on the other side of the equation, we get sort of reports usually coming from Radio Free Asia, who they, have sourced with people, usually through dissident groups on the ground, who actually have a different sort of agenda to sell, who pitch it in a different direction. And one suspects that, in fact, reality lies somewhere in between. But, you know, we don't really know. And so it's very difficult, I think, to know exactly always what's happening out in the province. But I do think that we can say that people, there is a growing body of people who feel disenfranchised enough that this is the only way that they can express themselves. And that is negative, no, whichever way you look at it.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think where you do see a greater level of organisation is in this willingness, if you like, to take the fight to the Han population. So yeah. I think I would point to the episode at Kunming Railway Station, which is not in Xinjiang. I mean, this is quite outside their territory. It was a lot of people, and it clearly took a lot of organisation. It was still done with knives, however.
It is still, though, mass casualty terrorism, I guess, to describe it that way. Do you think that's one of the problems, perhaps, that some in the West, and as you were talking, Raffaello, about the sort of the lack of availability of good, accurate reporting, because it's often biased in one way or the other. Is that a problem for us as well, do you think, in terms of actually labelling it? Or do you think we should try and resist that temptation? There's no need to do that. And we should actually look at the reasons behind it rather than what's actually happening.
I think a terrorist incident, you know, the incident of the bomb throwing in the market is a terrorist incident. I think we don't have any problem with that. What we do have a problem with is understanding who these people are, what their organisation consists of, you know, what if any connections they have to any international jihad. I mean, the Chinese argue that this is all promoted from outside, that people are radicalised by the internet, that, you know, exile groups are sponsoring it. And actually, they do not produce evidence for that. And so I think that's our difficulty. It's getting a sense of, you know, is this one movement? Is it many movements? Is it, you know, frustrated individuals? To what degree is their organisation? Where is it coming from? These are all questions to which we really don't have answers.
Raffaele, if we delve in a bit more detail then and look at the sort of the success or failure of the state to sort of assimilate non-Han populations either in this district and more widely, the PRC, obviously there's this idea of a unitary state, a multi-ethnic state. Is that realistic? Was it ever?
Well, I think, you know, the China talks about being a sort of multicultural place, and it has got, I think it's 52 ethnicities or minorities.
Well, it has 55 formally. It has many more.
But it has many more. 55 formally. But, you know, when we look at the numbers, I mean, we're talking about, I think, a population is 90% plus Han Chinese, and that minority is 55 or however many it is, crams into that last little 10%. So really, they're talking about a population that's overwhelmingly monoethnic already. I think when we're talking about Xinjiang in particular, what has struck me about the government's sort of policy towards the province, it's been quite binary. I think on the one hand, it's been a policy of very heavy economic investment, you know, and sort of classic Chinese government model of, you know, make everyone rich and happy, and then they won't want to fight and rebel against the state because they'll have houses and jobs and whatever. And then on the other hand, they've got a very sort of hard security crackdown and a very heavy sort of police presence and military presence across the province. And what's really missing is the sort of middle element, because, you know, people don't get motivated to do these sorts of acts either because they lack money or because, you know, they can sort of get away with it because they're in a police state. They're motivated to do it because they feel there's a sense of having no stake in society and the society that they're living in. I think what's interesting is that we just saw a few weeks ago or in the past month, there was a big work conference. And this was the second big work conference that the CCP has held about Xinjiang in particular. And looking at particularly Xi Jinping and some of the other speeches that come out of that, they seem to be trying to grasp this fact. And they do seem to be trying to reach towards trying to understand more of this assimilation question. How do they get these Uyghurs to feel like they have a stake in Chinese society? And they do have a role within it, and they are a welcome part of it. Have they got that approach right yet? I don't think they've quite figured it out, but I think we're starting to see evidence that they recognize this is a problem, and they are trying to grasp towards some sort of solution. But, you know, the problem here is that if they start to reach too much towards one specific minority, then this Han majority starts to feel like they're getting left out and they're not benefiting in some way. And so it's this sort of tension that the government has to sort of balance.
I think historically, sorry if I may, it's also quite helpful to remember that these are rather recently incorporated territories. And the Chinese state does say China is, you know, eternal and unchanging. But actually, if you look at the map of China at the end of the Ming Dynasty in 1644, it's half the size. So these territories were incorporated under the Manchu Empire, not Han Chinese, Manchu, Central Asian power. And in Xinjiang's case, was resisted, you know, right through the 19th century. Tibet, less so. But nevertheless, the states when you come to the Republic, to the modern era, the state's policy has been one of colonization. Mm. And that is, you know, one of the things that's at the root of the problems that, that Raphael talks about, that explicit state-sponsored colonization, which means that incoming Han Chinese tend to get the jobs, tend to get the subsidies, tend to do the business. And the economies, the traditional economies, become marginalized. Mm. And so the people become marginalized. So they're sitting there looking at people that they regard as invaders and incomers and the destruction of their you know, heritage, their way of life, and indeed their economy. It's very difficult to incorporate them into those economies. And that creates a large body of resentment, which takes many forms. And in this recent set of episodes has taken violent forms.
It's an intriguing discussion. Let's move on and talk a little bit about China's Li Keqiang, who's visited the UK just in the last week, visited the Queen, suggested Scotland shouldn't leave the UK, good to get some pointers, of course, among other things, signed £14 billion worth of trade deals. His team, though, were apparently rather disgruntled about the length of the red carpet rolled out on arrival, but otherwise everything seemed to go fairly well. We'll talk about the red carpet row in a moment. But what about, Raffaella, this generally, this visit to some various EU countries, actually, first since he took office last year, deals too with Greece. A successful visit? Or is it wrong to look at things in terms of success and failure? Are there other nuances we should perhaps be picking out?
Well, I think this was a successful visit from the perspective of lots of deals were signed. We got a bit more clarity about what it is that, you know, China is seeking to do with the UK. And it was sort of an official affirmation of something that we've known has been happening for a while, which is that the UK is officially being taken out from the sort of freezer. I think UK-China relations had been put in a sort of awkward space, and the Prime Minister, I think, had been turned down or had his meetings cancelled or moved around twice, I believe. And I think the point of this was, you know, you're officially now friends again. But I think the Chinese did this in a way to emphasize that they still hold the upper hand. We had the ambassador gave what I thought was a really quite rude speech just before on the eve of the visit, in which he said, you know, the UK still isn't that important in the European context. Really, France and Germany are more important than you guys. And then this whole row about the carpet, which is the quintessential storm in the teacup. There's a wonderful quote in the Financial Times who I think broke the sort of story. And they said that apparently Ed Llewellyn's office, the Prime Minister's sort of foreign policy advisor, when they'd asked him about this, he said, I don't have time for this. And I was like, that's exactly right. This is a completely irrelevant thing. But it's exactly the sort of thing that I think the Chinese have form of sort of pinpricking this situation and saying, OK, fine, we're going to do all the big deals. We'll sign all this big stuff. You want trade with us, but we'll still demonstrate that we have the upper hand here. And I thought that was, frankly, a little distasteful, some of the ways that the Chinese did it this time around.
Isabel, would you go along with that? I mean, surely the diplomatic playing field is one ripe for, you know, pricking the pomposity of former colonial powers. It's a bit of... Could we put this down as good-natured banter?
I think I'd go a little further than that. I think it was a demonstration of the folly of kowtowing to the Chinese. You know, it's true that the Prime Minister was in the freezer, or the, you know, the fridge at least, since about 14 months since he met the Dalai Lama. But if you look at the volume of trade and business that was done in that time... It went on fine. Right. Actually, it went up. And I think that the mistake that this government made was to imagine that, you know, the political intervention by the Prime Minister was either necessary for trade, or that you should sacrifice the political relationship for the promise of trade. Because the Chinese are highly pragmatic. Yeah. They're interested in three big sectors here in terms of investment. They're interested in high-speed trains, telecoms, and nuclear. They would do those deals, frankly, anyway. And I think that the rather calculated insults, and these things don't happen by chance, are just to remind Britain that, you know, they grovelled and don't think that we're friends in any way, but we will toss a little business your way. What we have consistently failed to do over decades is sell very much to China, and that hasn't changed. So essentially, you know, at the end of last year and the beginning of this year, Britain said to China, look, we've got a very cheap country, you know, would you like to buy some of it? And the Chinese said, yeah, all right.
Well, I mean, I was just going to say that I think Isabel's 100% right that business goes ahead, all guns blazing. I've spoken to plenty of businessmen sort of either side of this and asked them this question about whether the sort of UK-China awkwardness is something that's had any impact. And they said, absolutely not. You know, the strategic industries that matter, the Chinese are going to invest in anyway and talk to people anyway. I would add on top of the industries that I think Isabel mentioned, I think the financial one is an interesting one. And I think this is something that the UK has gone quite big on trying to say, you know, we're a major financial hub. And if you're going to internationalize the renminbi, London's the place to do that. And I think we started to get a little bit more clarity around what that exactly means and how that plays. I think what's interesting is the Chinese actually have said that they're not really going to make London the only one.
Yeah, they did looking a deal to with do Germany.
Exactly. They're talking to Frankfurt as well, yeah. And they're doing a lot through Hong Kong already. So, you know, I think that the UK has tried to big up that one, but I think it's one that they're spreading around.
The Chinese
just briefly on that point, I just wondered, is it a political failure then from Britain, if you like, and its institutions not to be better at selling that? Or is it an economic failure? Is it a failure to actually engage with the kind of pragmatism that you described a moment ago?
Well, it's partly that the Chinese economy and the British economy are not a particularly good fit. The major trading relationship is with Germany, which still makes things and China still buys them. We do services. And I guess the hope is that in the next phase of Chinese economic development, China will open up to British services. I think the chances of that are vanishingly small myself. I think you'll see the same thing that you've seen in, you know, high-tech manufacture, where the Chinese will give you one big contract and then they'll learn how to do it, as they have with nuclear and high-speed trains, and then they will outcompete you in third markets. And I would sup with a very long spoon indeed, frankly. But I think that our failure to sell is that we don't produce what China wants. And so... You know, we don't do very well in that regard.
I like to always end each little segment on an upbeat note. Yeah. That wasn't really one, but you're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. That was Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue. Raffaello Panciucci from RUSI is here with us. When we come back, we'll look to the Middle East and North Africa too. Stay tuned.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favorites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favorites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Insta paper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, 23 minutes past the hour here in London. Still with me, Raffaello Panciucci from RUSI and Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue. US Secretary of State John Kerry is in Iraq today, having been sent by Obama to meet with Iraqi PM Nouri al-Maliki to discuss security in the nation, amongst other things. Meanwhile, extremist group the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, ISIS, is expanding its control of towns in the northwest and more widely, reportedly trying to take control of a dam near the city of Haditha. Raffaello, if I can come to you first of all, John Kerry has vowed intense support from the US. What does that look like exactly?
I think it's really about bolstering the sort of Iraqi capacity to respond to this problem. I think it's probably about increasing intelligence efforts there. I think it's about increasing maybe the presence of certain special forces units on the ground. They've already sent about 300 or so advisors, I think, to bolster the Iraqis. And then I think it's about, you know, retransferring some drones that maybe have been sent elsewhere to help provide the Iraqi forces with a sort of overwatch. I even think we might start to see targeted strikes against both from drones and potentially even airstrikes against specific sort of ISIS bases. But I think it's mostly about trying to bolster the sort of Iraqi capacity and giving it that sort of edge that the sort of American special forces and, you know, technical capability has to provide rather than any sort of heavy presence of US forces.
One of the other things as well that Kerry has said is that the Iraqi leadership faces a moment of decision. Is he being slightly disingenuous? It's not really about anything that al-Maliki or anyone else, frankly, there decides to do or not do, is it?
Well, it may well be about things that they have done which weren't too smart. I mean, at the moment, we've essentially got three forces fighting in Iraq. We've got the Kurds, who are probably quite tough and defending their territory, and then there are the Shia militia in the south, and the ones that are not doing very well is the Iraqi army, and you've got this mosaic of competing interests, and actually not that, you know, that even the Shia support for Maliki is not particularly solid. Mm. I mean, you've seen dissenting voices in the Shia community. Iran wants him to stay on. And now that, you know, I think the US would, given its druthers, probably have a more accommodating leader in Iraq, because his record has been one of alienating other ethnosis, other groups in Iraq. So he's trying to, you know, deal with this very aggressive rebellion, and he doesn't seem to have either the tools or the solidarity that might be necessary. So it seems to me that Iraq is drifting towards partition quite firmly, and that in the end, Maliki will be a rather sad note in history.
What does any subsequent leadership look like then, Raphael? I mean, is that people have talked a long time about the sort of historical roots of this division, these ethnic divides, the very arbitrary geographical divides that were often imposed, you know, over the last 100, 200 years. It's an unmanageable situation, isn't it, for anybody?
Well, I'm not so sure that I would look at it in this sort of totally catastrophic fashion. I have a suspicion that, yes, it's true, these barriers, these lines, borders that we see. And if you look at a map, they are pretty ridiculous borders. These very, very straight lines that, you know, were clearly done by someone sitting in the old Admiralty with a nice sort of, you know, as you read the Financial Times, oh, well, we'll draw a map there.
Sykes-Picot.
Exactly. There we go. Yes. Oh, that's wonderful. So I think that's certainly true. However, I think the fact that you have got these states now exist, I think that they will probably preponderate. I think the real problem here was very much, as I think Isabel was alluding to, that Maliki really did a very poor job of trying to integrate Sunnis within his sort of regime. In fact, he pushed sectarianism really as a key platform of advancing his sort of popularity and success and leadership amongst the very specific Shia community. So I think the question is really, how long will he survive and who comes next? And if this next person can actually be more of a sort of unifying figure. If we look to Afghanistan, for example, it's another country which is very artificial and has a whole patchwork of nationalities there. However, Karzai was an interesting figure because while he was hated by the West and everyone else and had a very awkward relationship with the Americans, he was seen as a father figure of the nation. And Afghans still talk about Afghanistan as a country, even though they are different between Pashtuns and Tajiks and Hazaras and everything else. I think the question is there some sort of a figure like that who we'll see emerge in Iraq? And I would suspect that, yes, over time, someone will. I think it's in everyone's interests to have these countries remain as coherent sort of structures as they are today. And so I think some leadership will eventually emerge. I think the other side of this equation is, of course, what happens to a group like ISIS. ISIS, as their name indicates, do not see this border. They see very much the Levant as one big space that they're going to set their proto-caliphate in. And so for them, it's very much about seeing across these borders in Anbar province and sort of Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor are parts, all one big country for them. But if we look at history, this is a group that has a good track record of basically going too far. And once they sort of start to really take control of territory, they start to throw themselves around a bit. They start to really do some horrible things. I mean, if you look at Raqqa, they're crucifying people pretty regularly there. Their punishments are really pretty brutal things. And populations don't necessarily like that. And so there's an element of you can only rule at the acquiescence of a population. If a population doesn't sort of accept you, then you'll get moved on. And so I would suspect that we'll see eventually they will go too far. And then we'll see, frankly, what we saw happening before when the Americans were looking to leave, the awakening, where you saw the Sunni tribes basically got angry at sort of al-Qaeda in Iraq's presence and rose up against it. And so I suspect we'll start to see that happening again. It'll just happen over a long period of time. And then the question is there a leader in Iraq who can capitalize on this to become a sort of unifying figure for the nation? Maliki clearly was not that. In fact, he was the opposite.
We'll have to wait and see whether there is anyone who can step into those shoes. Let's just end by talking briefly about Egypt, the trial of the Al Jazeera journalists in Cairo. We've had some verdicts. Peter Gresti, Mohamed Fahmy and Bah Mahmoud were convicted of spreading false news and supporting the Muslim Brotherhood and received sentences varying between 7 and 10 years. Some other offences were taken into account there. Three other foreign journalists tried in absentia have also received long sentences. I just wonder as well, Kerry was in the country recently. We've had Blair sticking his oar in, as usual. Plenty of pounds for military equipment, or dollars, I should say, from Kerry, what, the day before, and then these verdicts come. Who should we really be blaming for this?
Well, there are plenty of people to blame. But it is a real slap in the face for the United States. Yeah. You know, they send a congratulatory telegram on the results of the election to Morsi, and they then, you know, pledge their support. Kerry comes and visits, restores military aid, and the next day, this appalling criminalization of journalism. Mm. And it puts the Americans in a slightly awkward position because they're not, you know, that warm about Al Jazeera. But nevertheless, you know, this is a core American value, if you like. Mm. And they have in all their statements said, well, we did press Mohamed Morsi, you know, on the freedoms of all Egyptians, including freedom of speech and all that kind of thing. And frankly, he said, well, you know, tough. We will do what we like. And I think this is, you know, in terms of the verdict and in terms of you know, these journalists being taken as pawns for the wider civil war, if you like, in the Middle East, this is about, you know, this is about Al Jazeera, which was and Qatar. So Qatar is accused of supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, and it ends up with a 7-year jail sentence for journalists on the ground who work for Al Jazeera, Qatari organization. But it is, I think that if the US doesn't say something very strong, and I haven't seen anything today from the US at all, then I think it's pretty shameful.
And there, I'm afraid we must leave it. Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, Raphael Panatucci from the Royal United Services Institute. Thank you both very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House. Thank you.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
It's 18:32 here in London. There's plenty still to come in the second half of the programme. South African author Ivan Vladisevic will join me in the studio to discuss his book, The Restless Supermarket. We'll check in with Natalie Svarikas in Athens, and Ossian Ward from the Listen Gallery will review The Week in Art. Before all of that, though, here's James Luckhurst with the latest world news headlines.
The US Secretary of State John Kerry has promised intense and sustained US support for Iraq, but says the country will only survive if its leaders take urgent steps to bring it together. Hours before Mr. Kerry arrived in Baghdad, Sunni tribes who've joined a militant takeover of northern Iraq seized the only legal crossing point with Jordan. The Qatari news agency Al Jazeera has urged Egypt to overturn a court ruling against three of its journalists, condemning the 7-year prison sentences as unjustified and defying logic. The three, who include Australian Peter Grester and Canadian-Egyptian national Mohamed Fahmy, deny the charges. Security sources in Nigeria say an explosion has torn through a state college in the northern city of Kano, killing at least 7 people. The explosion hit the Kano State School of Hygiene, though it's not immediately clear if Islamist rebels were behind the attack. And the Israeli army has detained another 37 Palestinians overnight as it searches for 3 missing teenagers. 361 people have now been held since the Israeli students went missing on June the 12th. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, James. More news from James Luckhurst at the top of the hour. That'll be 1900, of course, here in London. You're listening to Midori House, live on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. We're ticking towards 1900 hours here in London. That means we're ticking towards 2100 in Athens. And that's where we're heading right now for a check on some of the big stories of the day in Greece. Our correspondent, Natalie Svarikas, joins us now. Natalie, thanks for joining us on the programme. As always, a murky business to kick off with, the drug smuggling trade. Tell us what's been happening.
It's absolutely astonishing. I mean, the ministers here have been referred to it as the largest seizure of heroin on a European level. What's essentially happened is in the past few days, we've had some close to 2 tons of that illegal drug that were discovered in 2 different raids. One was in a warehouse in Athens and the other one just a few days ago. Now, several crew members of a Togo flag tanker have been arrested, including the Greek ship owner, and they're meant to face an examining magistrate tomorrow and on Wednesday. Now, of course, the Balkans and the Greece being on the tip of the Balkans, they're an extremely key route for trade coming in from Asia via Turkey to the rest of Europe. And essentially, that's what they wanted to do. The shipment of heroin was slowly going to start being traded in markets across Europe.
Pretty extraordinary stuff and incredible numbers. I just wondered, is this always greeted as a kind of a PR triumph, or are people actually more delighted about the practical impact, you know, getting the drugs off the streets, getting it away from reaching these other key markets in Europe? Or do you think it's more of a PR coup, do you think?
Bit of both, I guess. But essentially, it's such a huge bust, if you like. And Greece has been so caught up in the financial crisis that, cuts have been happening left, right and center, especially when it comes to drug enforcement, monitoring all these activities. So it is a huge success, of course, for the authorities, but also quite a bit of a PR stunt. And Greece having so many thousands of islands and hundreds of inhabited islands, it's extremely difficult to control the flow of either illegal narcotics or other sorts of trafficking. And that is the big challenge that the authorities face. So a bit of PR here isn't all that bad for them, I think.
Let's talk a bit about Golden Dawn, Natalie. Unfortunately, we so often touch upon them, but what are they up to at the moment? Testifying, I gather, before the magistrates where you are.
Well, the reason why this is such an important story in Greece is essentially because it denies its links to Nazism. And yet every so often what we've had is, you know, all sorts of evidence resurfaces where you see pictures of its leadership in Nazi gear, essentially praising the Hitler and Nazi salutes, etc., despite, you know, many of its voters or the larger part of its voters not wanting to believe that this is actually a Nazi party. And in the meanwhile, what we have is a third of its leadership which is behind bars. Many of its MPs and other senior party officials are now testifying before an examining magistrate these days. Today what we had was one of the leading MPs has testified again. He got it extended to another day. The wife of the leader is also expected to testify. I mean, all this is happening. We don't know when the trial is meant to start. And all of this, of course, attracts a lot of publicity around the party and all these pictures that have been surfacing, but more interestingly, testimonies from previous high-ranking officials which say that the Golden Dawn's master plan here is for Greece to be essentially a one-party state.
And Natalie, let's finish by looking at something a little more on the bright side. Film festival of the open-air variety, appropriately enough, in the summer months here in Europe. Tell us about Athens's version, something everyone's looking forward to.
Absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, the open-air cinema, which is a big tradition in Greece, not only in the capital, we have various open-air cinemas, but also across the country, is quite in decline. I mean, people are more attracted to the multiplex, etc., but it's quite a unique experience. So what the authorities here have come up with is a way to boost it by organizing this open-air festival. And what we have is huge screens that will be set up in parks or in the gardens of museums or close to historic landmarks like the Academy of Plato. You know, it's meant to attract and remind Greeks of the beauty of the open-air cinema, watching some great movie under the stars while sipping on a cocktail, for example.
That sounds pretty good to me, Natalie. I hope you do get away to enjoy that as well. That was our Natalie Savarakis reporting from Athens. Up next, South African author Ivan Vladislavic will join me here in the studio to discuss his book, The Restless Supermarket, just out here in the UK.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
You're listening to Midori House, ticking towards 20 minutes for the top of the hour. I'm Tom Edwards. Now, the World Cup in Brazil is, of course, well underway. You've probably noticed. At Monocle 24, we've been bringing you the tournament's alternative national anthems, the songs that capture some of the spirit of each of the 32 nations who are battling it out in Brazil. In this instalment, we head to Mexico, who are playing Croatia a little later. According to Manuel Diaz-Cebrian, director of the Mexico Tourist Board, there's one traditional folk song, made perhaps most famous by the American singer Ritchie Valens in the late 1950s, that still has the capacity to bring Mexicans all across the country together. This is, and it could only be, La Bamba.
La Bamba is actually a very joyful song. It comes probably from bamboleo, which is to shake. So it's La Bamba. Actually, just the name evocates, I guess, the rhythm for you. It's a song from the state of Veracruz, which is so close to Cuba. And it has all these roots in Mexican, African, and obviously Spanish rhythms. And it's one of the most famous Mexican songs. Some people believe it's not Mexican because it's been popular and performed by many American and British singers, and especially Los Lobos, this important group that actually died in a horrendous crash. But yes, obviously due to that, it's been widely popular. We don't know exactly, I mean, much about the history. It was just created as in the state of Veracruz, as I told you. Yes, Veracruz is a coast, very warm and lovely town. The people of Veracruz had the reputation to be a happy people all the time. So this song is about just putting you in a good mood. It was created originally to be only like folkloric dance, and from that jump into a different level. It's in a way, it could be translated, but it's not really social, but it's about talking about people from the coast. It's a sailor, I'm a captain. So it's about conquering someone and telling this someone that is his range is better than the one she believes she is. And the lyrics are very interesting. It's like, to go to the sky, I just need two stairs, one big and one small. It's kind of symbolic. It's kind of a song that, in a way, flirts in order to attract you. That used to be a song performing weddings, but since the music and the lyrics became popular since in the 50s, because it became like a kind of a rock and roll song, is a song that actually became a song that you dance and actually change your spirit. And obviously, for any Mexicans, when you listen to La Bamba, immediately you do this. Porque es arriba y arriba y arriba. Yo no soy marinero. It's fantastic. It's a lovely song. It's a song appropriate for the summer. It's obviously a song which is a joyful song. It's a song that actually comes from the coastline. And obviously because it's a song once you listen to, you feel pride and you feel great, because it's a song that has transcend frontiers and evocates and means music. If you play that song, actually people will just get crazy and scream, and actually just because everybody knows the lyrics of this song. There are so many other songs, like Cucaracha, for example, but I think La Bamba is more like a funny, it's more like an appropriate for this occasion, for the World Cup. I love it. And Mexico is a very musical country, more than a dancing country. We love singing. So I say, well, La Bamba is great.
That was La Bamba, as discussed by Manuel Diaz Cebrian, director of the Mexico Tourist Board, explaining why the song is Mexico's alternative national anthem. Now, lucky subscribers all around the world will already have discovered the delights of the Quality of Life issue, the July-August summer special double issue of Monocle magazine. And we're looking at the quality of life all this week on the station. We're talking about some of the great buildings that feature in some of the great cities they're in. One such is Toronto. And although more people are probably looking to Toronto City Hall because of the antics of Rob Ford, the building itself shouldn't be overlooked in the eyes of Christopher Frey, who wrote all about it for us in the magazine. And we wanted to find out a bit more. So our Alla John asked Chris more about Toronto City Hall.
Well, it really is the only piece of iconic architecture of any global significance in the city, I think. Of course, there is the CN Tower, which was for 30-some-odd years the world's tallest freestanding structure, and several people are probably familiar with it. But Toronto City Hall has such an amazing story, and its arrival in 1965 really marks the birth of the modern-day city. Not only did it transform downtown, it really spurred this growth or this large-scale downtown development that didn't exist before. And it announced the arrival of a more modern city. Toronto was a fairly provincial, bit of a backwater place up until the mid-60s. It was the second city in Canada after Montreal, which was the financial center and economic center of the country, and cultural. But I think that shift in 1965, you have the building itself, which has an incredibly, what some would say, futuristic, but I mean perhaps avant-garde design. And the fact that this backwater of a place chose this design by Villiers-Ravel through what was at the time the world's largest international open design competition. Now we take these kind of big open design competitions for granted, but back then it was a new thing, and that within the design world at least helped put Toronto on the map. So there was the design of this building, which was, if you look at it, it's highly symbolic. It's a very open plain. It has these two curving towers that cradle the council chamber in the middle, which is in the form of a bit of a flying saucer, I guess we call it, or a clamshell. And all of that is on top of a three-story podium. And you have this massive public square in front, which up till then Toronto didn't even have. So I think there's this symbolic function that City Hall provides. But in terms of historically 1965, it wasn't just the arrival of this rather odd building for its time. But at that same moment, Canada was liberalizing its immigration laws. And so it sort of overlapped with this sort of emergence of a new multicultural Toronto, which, I mean, now Toronto has more foreign-born residents than any other world city. So I think those two things taken together give it a really great story.
Chris, looking at the symbolism then, you mentioned there it kind of sort of marks a place in the history of Toronto's life there that you see an introduction of modern architecture and modernism across the city, and it was kind of a bellwether for a beginning of a new place that Torontonians could enjoy. Is there more to it than that? Was it well received, or has it always been well received? Often we talk about architects and the design community getting very excited about new developments, but actually the public aren't actually that enthusiastic about it.
Yeah, I think it's had an interesting lifespan. And next year it'll be 50 years. So it's coming upon like an interesting historic moment. While it created a lot of excitement in the design and architecture community, I think locals loved the attention, I think, that came with its inauguration initially. You've got these great shots from opening night with sort of floodlights cast against the towers, and you have this remarkable ramp that travels up the front of the building to the third story podium on which the flying saucer is perched, which was intended for thing like ceremonial things like the Queen being able to drive up in her automobile right up to the top of the building. So it was all quite fantastic. I think once the initial novelty wore off, Toronto had fairly nascent design values, I'd say, at that time. While there were a lot of great buildings starting to emerge in the 1960s, and the building Toronto City Hall did help legitimize modern architecture in the city, by and large, I mean, it would take many decades, I think, for culturally the city to shift in City Hall's favor. So you saw in the 70s and 80s, aspects of the square fell into disrepair, or these rather clumsy additions were added that only cluttered the place. And even the floor plan within the towers, you had it basically divvied up into cubicles over the years. And I think you lost some of the grandeur of the view from these curving towers that sort of face into each other. In the last 10 years, I think it's interesting how it corresponds with Toronto's own growing sense of confidence and prominence on the world stage. I mean, long ago, Toronto overtook Montreal as sort of de facto financial and cultural capital. But at the same time, you know, globally, it's starting to play a much more significant role. Certainly one of the financial centers in the world now, and the banks here survived the economic crisis of the past few years fairly well. And the building boom has never stopped. I mean, in the past, it's often quoted here that, you know, Toronto still has like the longest growth spurt in the last sort of 5 to 10 years in terms of building. There has been no lull, and there's been no shortage of construction cranes in the sky. And I think somehow aesthetically, the city has grown into it. So that symbolism I talked about, that sort of spirit of openness and optimism and looking forward and transparency, despite some of the recent dysfunction we've seen at City Hall, the city has rather nicely grown into it and kind of embraced it. I mean, it mirrors my lifespan, having been born in 1970, that I recall wondering what is this building, and maybe we weren't really sure what to think of it. But I think a lot of that old insecurity is gone, and we've just come to appreciate it as the one true symbol of our city.
Looking at its recent history then, Chris, it has played host to a rather saucy soap opera for the last year, at least, putting it in the nicest possible terms. Has it sort of acquired a new kind of symbolism to Torontonians?
I don't know if it's a new symbolism. It's interesting how it's become the set, I guess, for, you know, the greatest political media circus of the past year or so. And I can't recall any other City Hall really being treated in the same way or getting this much global attention. I think it will always, the symbolism of the building will always transcend sort of whatever dysfunction is happening within. And in fact, I think it's sort of endeared people, this building to the city. Even more so because it has been part of the daily news, both locally and internationally. You turn on the TV and that's in the background for this soap opera that's been unfolding. So if anything, I think it may have enhanced people's ties. And I know there have been at times where, despite the embarrassment we might have felt about Rob Ford and his antics, there might have been this sort of, you know, back of the brain, little hint of pride, I think, at seeing our City Hall represented. And I think what's interesting is, no, I can't really think of any city for whom their primary symbol or icon is actually the City Hall, the seat of democracy, the place where citizens run the city. And I think there's something heartening about that.
That was Christopher Frey in Toronto, talking about the city's City Hall with Alla John. You can read more about that and other great buildings and great cities, indeed, in the July-August issue of Monocle on newsstands or lucky subscribers' doormats right now. You're listening to Midori House. We're ticking towards the top of the hour, and with time to talk art now. I'm joined by Ossian Ward of the Listen Gallery here in London. Ossian, welcome.
Hi.
Now, where should we start? Let's talk maybe a little bit about Marina Abramović, who's, okay, I think, is it fair to say, divided little opinion. Quite a lot of sort of critiques, interesting sort of discussion about her show at the Serpentine. And I've been a little surprised by how sort of acid some of the criticism has been. What have you made of it? It's been quite an interesting dialogue, hasn't it?
Yeah, I suppose the idea that there's been some sort of cult of celebrity is what people are focusing on. But I think the way that she's done this performance, which is called 512 Hours, is to strip it down to just being her. So obviously the focus is on her, but in effect she's trying not to kind of align herself too much with celebrity, or, you know, I don't think she's doing this to kind of promote herself necessarily. She's just trying to do something that's brave and difficult, like she did at MoMA a couple of years ago when she sat down in the atrium and didn't move for, you know, 3 months. This is different. This is more interactive. So in some ways, a bit more generous. I'm not quite sure why people think that it's somehow. I mean, you know, she's not just on display. She's talking to people and talking them through exercises. And, you know, it's quite an interesting space to be in because you actually get to be with the artist. She'll might take your hand. She might take you around. She might whisper something to you. She may, you know, that anything can happen and it changes every day. So I think, you know, there's always going to be a big blitz at the beginning and what's she doing and why is she sat in a gallery and, you know, taxpayers' money and, you know, but by the end of it, you know, it'll be interesting to see how the whole thing develops over a couple of months. You know, she said herself, wait until August, you know, and then see what will happen, you know, because she says she's going to open the doors every day. She'll be the first person to greet visitors and the last person to lock the door at night. So by the end of August, you know, God knows what she's going to be.
Who
feeling.
Knows where we're going next? Yeah. Let's talk about another big personality, I guess. I know you've been in Venice recently.
Yeah.
And the Architecture Biennale, curated by Rem Koolhaas.
Yes.
Now, that's another big character, right?
Yeah, and he's done the very deft thing of taking out all architects from his show. So usually if you're the director of, or the curator of the Venice Architecture Biennale, you will show your colleagues' work and, you know, show the sort of where architecture is now. He's chosen to focus on the fundamentals of architecture, the doors, the windows, the ceilings, the, you know, table tops, and it's broken it down in a very interesting way. And the show is incredibly theatrical. So you walk in and you see the gubbins that you might find under a false ceiling, above a false ceiling, so the ducts and, you know, all that kind of stuff that is hidden by architects. And, you know, he's trying to show that there's these sort of these heroes of architecture without actually saying, oh, by the way, I'm also a star architect. And, you know, of course, my work is above all of this. But no, it's an interesting and radical proposal, but a way of kind of shuffling architecture off to the side. Indeed, that his opening salvo was to say, you know, over 100 years we've had architecture change from being amazing vernacular styles in different parts of the world to all being homogenous glass and steel, and it all looks the same now. But he's part of that dialogue as well, you know, he's part of the problem as much as the solution. So yeah, controversial but entertaining exhibition.
Maybe he won't be invited to curate any more shows anytime soon. Who knows?
Well, I mean, with his curation, the Venice Architecture Biennial has gained a lot. You know, that he told them he wanted it to be on till November. He wanted it to be much more structured. And so he got what he wanted. So, you know, maybe it will force the Architecture Biennale to come up a notch.
Let's talk briefly about the Hayward Gallery. I know you've been there recently. Now, what's not to love about mannequins, I always think. But apparently you can have too much of a good thing.
You can have too many. Remind me the exact show, the name of the show.
This is The Human Factor,
the
figure in contemporary sculpture.
Yeah, and now that sounds a bit like, I mean, The Human Factor. It just doesn't, it doesn't really tell you much about the show. The show is about bodies in contemporary art. And you would have thought, yes, the mannequin does appear. And yes, the kind of lifelike sculpture. Yes, the sort of, the doll, you know, all these kind of themes are in there, but unfortunately they sort of repeat themselves a bit, like there's kind of too many people. It's a bit like being on a packed tube train. They don't vary very much. You know, you see, oh, there are some mannequins looking like that. There are some ones that are a bit charred. There's ones that are made out of wood. And, you know, you don't get enough. It's funny to say, you know, given that humans are endlessly variable, but you don't get enough variety. Walking into Maurizio Cattelan's room where you're faced by a child looks like kneeling on the floor facing away from you, and you walk towards it and then you find it's Hitler kneeling. That's super powerful, super funny, you know, a very Catalan kind of gesture. But, you know, he sits on his own, you feel a bit more like you're in touch with something, whereas it does become a bit of a jumble sale when you're looking at all these mannequins thinking it's TK Maxx or something.
Ossian Ward of the Listen Gallery, many thanks for coming on Midori House today and talking us through some of the big stories in the world of art. It's all we have time for on today's programme. My thanks in particular to our special guests earlier, Raffaello Pantucci and Isabel Hilton. Today's show is produced by Ella John, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Johan Laux, and our studio manager was Joel Church. We'll be back at 1800 hours tomorrow. That's the very same time for those of you who aren't paying attention. But for this edition of Midori House, that is all. Goodbye. Have a great day.
From London to Beijing.
This is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam,
a Bogota
to Hong Kong,
all around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.